Hey guys, it's Al, and thanks for coming to my show. Today I've got Dr. Rex Curry coming in just a little bit, and looking forward to that. So stay tuned while we get some of that going on. Right now, we're going to play a little music first to warm us up. How about just a quickie with this one right here? Oops, that's not it. There we go.
Perfect day.
One, and a two, and... Well, it hurts from the bottom, and it hurts down to your soul. That's because true love is not nice, and it brings up hurt from when you were 5 years old. That's because true love is not nice. No. Oh, pain, pain, pain. Ain't that just love's name? Love can bring up hurt from way down low. It now be emphasized, true love is just not civilized. True love is not nice, no, no. Well, you've been hurt before, but now you're hurting so. True love is not nice. If it's real love, then that hurt won't go well. True love is not nice. Oh, pain, pain, pain. Rain, rain, rain. That's why he felt love's arrow and said, oh. Well, you knew from your first flirt that love was here to hurt. And that's because true love is not nice. No, no.
The pledge to resist. We believe that as a people living in the United States, it is our responsibility to resist the injustices done by our government in our names. Not in our name will you wage endless war. There can be no more deaths, no more transfusions of blood for oil. Not in our name will you invade countries, bomb civilians, kill more children, letting history take its course over the graves of the nameless. Not in our names will you erode the very freedoms you have claimed to fight for. Not by our hands will we supply weapons and funding for the annihilation of families on foreign soil. Not by our mouths will we let fear silence us. Not by our hearts will we allow whole peoples or countries to be deemed evil. Not by our will and not in our name. We pledge resistance. We pledge alliance with those who have undercome attack for voicing opposition to the war or for their religion or ethnicity. We pledge to make common cause with the people of the world to bring about justice, freedom, and peace. Another world is possible, and we pledge to make it real. Real. Real.
music, please.
Okay, and on the line with me, I've got Dr. Rex Curry. Hi, Dr. Curry.
Hey, Al. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. I saw your website and the provocative photographs that were on there of small children giving the what I call the Nazi salute to the American flag. And I was like, what the heck is this? So I'd never seen that before. And I wanted to talk to you about the history of the Pledge of Allegiance and about the fruits of that pledge and where it what's happened.
Well, you're right. You never see it because nobody wants to show it to you. It's very rare that anyone in the lamestream media will ever print that photo. And of course, they also won't teach you anyone in the government schools or show them the photos or tell them the history. All you get is the lame propaganda that the government schools give you, very shallow stuff, if anything, about it. Although they do try to, by law, lead children in many schools, many states, every morning in robotic chanting of the pledge.
Right.
And then they don't want to show you its history.
Yeah.
I was like you the first time I saw a photograph long time ago. I thought, how bizarre. And I started to do some research. The more research I do, the scarier it gets. And I actually became the person who discovered that the USA's Pledge of Allegiance is the origin of the salute of the National Socialist German Workers Party, the straight-arm salute. And that, of course, the National Socialist German Workers Party, a lot of people don't know, is the Nazi Party. The Nazi is basically a shorthand reference for National Socialist German Workers Party.
Mm-hmm. So they saw that, I mean, there was no... Well, isn't there some kind of belief that the Nazi salute came from an old Roman?
Exactly. That's actually a modern myth. The explanation is it's supposed to be a Roman salute. There's no evidence to support that. And if you look at any people who try to make that argument, what they usually end up pointing at is they'll end up pointing at a neoclassical painting by Jacques-Louis David, who's a French painter, and of course that was in the late 1700s, I think, or early 1800s. Well, of course, had nothing to do with ancient Rome, and there is no ancient Roman salute, and there's various ways that the myth about the Roman salute probably started, and I'll be happy to go into that also. There's various ways. One way is that Francis Bellamy, the author of the original Pledge of Allegiance, was from Rome, New York. And strangely enough, this is even true still today and back then. That was in 1892 when he wrote the Pledge of Allegiance. People referred to people from Rome, New York as Romans.
Oh.
They still do. It's just something funny they like to do because it's called Rome, New York. Of course, you know, the reason they call it the Empire State is interesting. A lot of people don't know. It's a reference to the Roman Empire. You know, New York State has a lot of cities that are named after classical places. Albany's one, Rome, Syracuse, you name it. It's not unlike a lot of cities that like to name towns after ancient Roman or Greek classical places. And, of course, there's other possibilities for why it ended up being called a Roman salute. And the amazing thing is to me that Francis Bellamy was a self-proclaimed socialist. And he was a socialist in what he called, he and his cousin, Edward Bellamy, the nationalism movement. And the USA at that time, this is like three decades easily before the creation of the National Socialist German Workers Party. Hmm. They worked together, Francis Bellamy and his cousin Edward Bellamy, and Edward was famous for, at that time, a book, an international bestseller, Looking Backward. It was a socialist utopian fantasy novel that was translated into every major language, including Russian, Chinese, and German, and it inspired almost immediately clubs, nationalism clubs, to promote his theories or his fantasy in his book, Looking Backward. And so that, of course, also occurred in Germany, as I mentioned. It was an international bestseller.
What was the basic gist of the book?
Oh, wow, it's incredible. You can still buy it. It's on. It's available easily, used ones and new ones. The gist of the book is a fellow falls asleep in 1888, and he sleeps until the year 2000, because actually the name of the book is Looking Backward, 2000 to 1888.
Huh.
And he wakes up in a modern Boston in 2000. And so, in effect, Edward Bellamy, through his fantasy, is predicting the year 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And the year 2000 is just a utopian socialism in which everyone has to be conscripted into the what they call the industrial army. That's their term. I'm not making this up. They said that favorably. They adored the military. They thought it was incredibly efficient. They also referred to their dogma, Edward Bellamy and Francis Bellamy, as military socialism. Huh. That was their phrase. They thought that was keen. And they wanted all of society to ape the military because they thought the military was so efficient. And they thought to themselves, gee, why can't we harness this wonderful system, the military system, and apply it to everything? Food, clothing, shelter, all goods and services, the industrial army, and we'll use the government schools to do that. They wanted the government to take over all the schools and thereby turn children into their little robotic, chanting socialist utopians who would they would be the industrial army, and then they would, of course, through government and socialism, be told what food, clothing, and shelter to make, and, you know, not unlike the crazy stuff that happened in the countries of what I call the socialist Holocaust, of which the Holocaust was a part, which was 65 million dead, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, about, who knows, 49 million dead under the People's Republic of China, and 21 million dead under the National Socialist German Workers' Party.
Right.
Those are the record holders for the worst killings, mass slaughter in the history of humanity. They take the top three slots still today.
Yeah. Wow. So these Bellamy brothers, and I guess the Francis was a cousin. There was a number of those.
Yeah. Right. Now they weren't. Those were probably the two most successful ones.
Mm-hmm.
Oddly enough, Edward had a couple of brothers, Charles and Frederick. Who were also socialists. They weren't as, how you'd say, aggressive as he was in writing his book and then proselytizing about imposing socialism on everyone. So Francis and Edward were the ones who met with the most popular success and did the most to spread their dogma all over the world.
So about the pledge, when Francis Bellamy wrote it, his idea was to indoctrinate the youth to have this sort of nationalistic fervor as part of the indoctrination of the children, and that's part of the whole sort of the mindset of these national socialists to have these government-run schools that indoctrinate the youth into... Yeah.
Exactly. Now, the excuse they used was a Columbus Day celebration. He was writing for the Youth Companion. When they hired him, they knew who he was. He already was well known for his socialism because he had actually lost his previous job, which was he was a minister, a preacher, and they canned him because he was using the pulpit basically to push his socialism, and supposedly on topics such as Jesus the Socialist. In fact, sometimes he referred to his ideology, he and Edward, as a Christian socialism. The original Pledge of Allegiance was actually part of a larger ceremony for a Columbus Day celebration, which is replete with his his reference. He not only makes a reference to Edward Bellamy's book, but he talks about the basically a new world order and marching under the flag and the industrial army and his dogma he's pushing in his program that he wrote along with the Pledge of Allegiance and the Youth Companion in 1892. Oddly enough, a lot of people don't realize this too. It's one of the items I picked up doing my research. He actually did use the phrase "under God" in the original ceremony. It wasn't part of the original pledge, but the pledge was part of a larger ceremony, which was replete with religious references as he was promoting his Christian socialism, which he was touting. And although it wasn't actually part of the pledge, some people act like they think that he wouldn't have liked the phrase. I think that what he wouldn't have liked is he wouldn't have liked people tinkering with his pledge without, you know, him doing it himself.
Right.
But to say that he didn't like the religious aspects is incorrect. He was you might call him a religious wacko, and he wrapped it all up into his Christian socialism, military socialism, industrial army, and he was booted out of preaching because of his attempts to push socialism through his ministry.
So I'm kind of curious, how it got to be so, did he do a lot of marketing of the pledge? How did it get to be the pledge, you know, rather than just sort of a nice thing that, you, I don't know, that Boy Scouts do or something like that?
Yeah, well, he obviously, one of his big successes was they wanted to nationalize everything and turn it into the industrial army and military socialism. They wanted the government to take over everything. Obviously, they were extremely successful in having the government take over all schools. That was part of the pledge program. He was denigrating non-government schools and openly advocating that the government should take over all schools. The government should handle all education and essentially take children from their parents in order to do that. Mm. And so he met with great success with that, as you know today, because most people are going to government schools and listening to propaganda, and amazingly enough, most of them start each day with a ring of a bell and a Pavlovian robotic chanting ceremony that is actually enshrined in the laws of these states that still do it, these oddball states that do it. And now, how did it spread? It spread it somewhat slowly. It started in 1892, and I guess more and more schools adopted it, and the government took over more and more schools and education across the nation. The other interesting part of it is the original pledge salute was not the hand over the heart. The original salute, as he wrote it in the Youth Companion in 1892, was a military salute, is how it would start. And the children would hold the military salute, which, of course, all ties in with his love for military socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And they would say, "I pledge allegiance," while holding the military salute, the standard salute as you know it today. And then they would extend the arm outward to the flag for the rest of the pledge.
Uh-huh.
In other words, military salute for "I pledge allegiance," and then extend the arm to the flag as if gesturing to the flag.
Interesting.
And although he had originally written it with the palm up towards the flag, as if gesturing towards the flag, when you look at the historical photographs, you see that that is not how children would perform it, which makes sense because they couldn't care less. They were being forced to do robotic chanting, and they just would not bother to turn their hand over when they were doing it.
Right.
So in that way, because he chose to start the pledge with the military salute, and because of the way children performed it by simply shoving the military salute out to the flag, that's how the straight arm classic hard stylized salute of the National Socialist German Workers Party began in the United States with the Pledge of Allegiance. And the National Socialist German Workers Party, of course, started in 1920. They had some electoral success in 1930, dictatorship in 33, and then in 39 they joined as allies with the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics to invade Poland and the pact, Molotov-Ribbentrop pact, to divide up Europe. All through this time, from 1892 on, we, unfortunately, in the United States, were doing more and more of this daily robotic chanting,
right,
to the point where it started to creep people out. Actually, I think the military salutes started to creep a lot of people out almost from the beginning, just because they thought it was oddball for children who were not in the military,
mm-hmm,
to be doing that. Some people even consider it disrespectful, you know, to pretend, you know, military rituals, even more screwier when children are doing it.
Right.
And it became even more cockamamie or disturbing as the National Socialist German Workers' Party started World War II and spread World War II. Of course, up till then, there were people who in the United States either liked the National Socialist German Workers' Party or they liked the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. So it all became incredibly confusing. And once the war started cranking up, and it became even more disturbing. And that's,
right,
believe it or not, it took till 1945 before Congress decided to inject itself into the mess and change it to the hand of the heart.
Huh.
We were already in World War II when Congress decided they were going to try to change the salute to the hand of the heart. Unbelievable, huh?
Yeah, that's amazing.
What's that?
It's amazing that's going on. You know, I just want to just throw in a little anecdote from my childhood. You know, I was raised saying the pledge in Pennsylvania until I moved to San Diego when I was 9, and they didn't really do it that much after that. My youth minister in a United Methodist church said his opposition to the Pledge of Allegiance was because he pledges no allegiance to any flag. He pledges his allegiance to God. As a minister, as a man of God, that's what he pledges his allegiance to, not to a flag. And,
well, I'm glad you.
And that made a lot of sense to me as a youth. I went, wow, that makes incredible sense. You know, so I just thought that was an interesting opinion.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting because the story gets even more terrifying. There were people way back when who didn't want to do it, and some of them were very religious people, and they used exactly the same reasoning as the man you refer to. They thought it was sacrilegious. They thought it was the worship of government.
Right.
And, of course, I agree with them. And of course, the graven image. It is sad to note that our government, the politicians, were persecuting these religious people in the USA for refusing to do the straight-arm salute to the flag. We were doing it even before the National Socialist German Workers' Party existed. They started in 1920.
Right.
So it's an interesting question as to, well, did they pick that up from us, or certainly we were already doing it. We were persecuting religious people for refusing to perform the straight-arm salute and chant robotically to the flag in government schools for years before the National Socialist German Workers' Party started doing it.
Right.
And it gets even crazier than that. Some of the people who did it the most were Jehovah's Witnesses. Well, guess what? They did that to them under the National Socialist German Workers' Party also. They were being persecuted and killed over there. Now, over here, there wasn't the same type of mass slaughter that occurred, but there was violence. The pledge, you know, all the yahoos who think they're patriotic by robotically chanting to the government in worship would attack people. The police would arrest people. There were incidents in which the government would take children away from their parents on allegations of unfit parenting because the parent wouldn't force the kid to do it, make the kid do it in school.
Wow.
And they would claim that it was disrupting the school because they weren't doing anything when other people wanted them to chant.
Right.
And this actually happened in the USA, and it happened before the National Socialist German Workers' Party. And if that isn't crazy enough, remember that the National Socialist German Workers' Party was also persecuting Jewish people. Huh. Well, a lot of people don't seem to realize this. We, the government, I'm not going to say we because it wasn't me, but right. the people in the government in the USA, way before the National Socialist German Workers' Party, were making Jewish people perform the straight arm salute to our flag and chant robotically. They were doing it all the way through 1945 until Congress decided that they were going to try switching to the hand over the heart.
Wow.
You never heard that in government schools, did you?
No. No. There's a lot I didn't learn in government
school. And you still won't. And you will probably never see one of these photographs, which, by the way, you can see at rexcurry.net. That's rexcurry.net. Hit the box at the top right or the links. It's not hard to find.
Right.
You could even do a search for Pledge of Allegiance or original Pledge of Allegiance, and you'll get the photographs I collect. I make a point of collecting them. I'm the only person that does it, and you will probably never see these things ever displayed on TV, in a newspaper, magazine, or discussed on radio even, other than, of course, I appreciate your having me on to talk about it.
Yeah. It's a fascinating thing. I'm kind of curious, maybe we can go into a little bit about your research into the connection to the Freemasons and how they sort of intertwine with the Nazis, and if there's a connection to this, Bellamy's crew and their whole mindset.
Sure, sure. And also, I probably forgot to mention this earlier. A lot of people, as I said, don't realize that the Nazis didn't call themselves Nazis.
Right.
That's just a term other people created. That the Nazis called themselves socialists, National Socialists, and of course the entire phrase for their actual party name was the National Socialist German Workers Party. One of the other things I discovered, which I thought was fascinating, is usually they tell you so little about Francis Bellamy. They occasionally will tell you that he was a socialist. They, in my experience, no one ever tells you that he was leading the nationalism movement at the time in the U.S.
Mm.
So in that sense, they would call themselves the National Socialists. Uh-huh. And one of the ways that you can remember what the what Nazi really meant, what they actually called themselves, is that the swastika was actually sometimes used as overlapping S letters for socialism.
Oh,
it was an
okay.
ancient symbol, mm-hmm. of course, way, very ancient, predated the German National Socialist by, forever.
Yeah.
But what he did, the head of the German National Socialist, was he took the swastika, turned it about 45 degrees to the horizontal, and he got to the point where he always used it to the right, clockwise,
mm-hmm.
in order to, of course, highlight the S shapes for socialism. It's not unlike what he did with his own bizarre signature, which is, you'll rarely see that shown to you. He basically changed Adolf to resemble a big S, stylized, the same kind of stylized S, and you can amazingly see similar alphabetical symbolism, which they were into back then, on VWs today. Same type of meshing of stylized letters, which is how they sometimes use the swastika. Which, by the way, they didn't call it a swastika. That's another big myth.
Wait, hold on. The W's? I'm not sure when you said W's. I didn't understand that.
The VW, the Volkswagen.
Oh, Volkswagen. Oh, okay, right.
Car,
okay.
Which,
yes.
of course, was created under German National Socialism.
Okay.
The same type of symbol. In fact, the amazing thing was the symbol for the Volkswagen was not originally VW. It was, in fact, a swastika inside of a cog wheel. Huh. Eventually, they went with the VW letters meshed instead. But is the line good enough? Am I speaking loudly?
Yeah, no, I got you. I just didn't quite understand the VW.
And, of course, there's another similar use in many, many ways. But one of the more well-known ones is the SS division itself, which was two S's side by side.
Right.
They sometimes describe them as runes.
Right.
Anyway, where was I going with this? So we were going into Freemasons, and right. Francis Bellamy, he was a Freemason. Francis Bellamy. And so was his the guy he was working with at the Hughes Companion when he wrote the Pledge of Allegiance.
Huh.
They were both Freemasons. And they used civic groups, including the Masons, to spread the pledge. They would go around and say, oh, yeah, great. This is a wonderful way to promote Bellamy's socialism and proselytize and get other people to do the Pledge of Allegiance at civic groups, and including the Masons. Now, as far as how that connects to the Germans, it's not perfectly clear whether the head of the German National Socialists picked it up through that manner. I think the thing that intrigues me the most about the civic groups and the Masonic angle is that all civic groups, or most, I should say today, seem to spout really vague altruism,
right.
which really, really translates into socialism. They don't seem to understand or explain or have any knowledge of supply and demand, free market economics, capitalism. And so I think all of these groups are prone to being used to promote totalitarian socialism and socialism. And that is, in fact, what Francis Bellamy was doing, as well as James Upham, the fellow he worked with at the Hughes Companion, who was also a very high Freemason. And, in fact, that's what happened under the National Socialists. They used civic groups to spread socialism. And if you ever read the goals or explanations of civic groups, such as the Freemasons, all you see is this really vague, feel-good, let's help everybody, yada, yada, socialism. It's basically an easy opening for socialism, and that's, to me, I think the biggest problem with the pledge and the tie-in with Bellamy and socialism, and eventually the mass slaughter that resulted from the worldwide spread of socialism during that time period.
Right. You know, but in the United States, to maybe get it a little bit more current, there's this sort of thing, like there's this sort of reverence for FDR because he put all these guys back to work with his New Deal and his sort of socialism light that got installed in the early 20th century with the income tax and these types of things, Social Security.
Yeah, actually, I count all of those as negatives. He didn't put people to work. He did impose the income tax, which is a horrible thing he did, and it still impoverishes us today. He also imposed a nationwide numbering. He did that at the height of the National Socialist German Workers' Party in 1935. He decided he also wanted to start numbering people,
mm-hmm.
and he used it as an excuse to steal from people and give your money to somebody else. To this day, they steal money from people who are the poorest people, flipping burgers or doing menial
right.
jobs, and they take their money and they give it to wealthy retired people who have more money than those other people will ever have in their lives.
Yeah.
And it's really just stealing. And FDR did not help people out. He drug out his depression, which was created by the Federal Reserve System and the inflation of the money supply.
Right.
He drug it out and got us into World War II as part of his cover for the mess he had created.
Right.
In fact, we went through World War II in the Depression. You could argue that the Depression wasn't even over after World War II, but it was such a big mess at that point, nobody could tell the difference.
I pretty much am right there with you on your analysis, but it gets spun in such a way that if you're critical of the government, then you're somehow you're either fallen, you know, it's like if you're critical of the government as we have it now, then you're either some kind of flaming liberal who has to feel the need to
tax everybody and take care of everybody and that the government's their daddy, or you're some paranoid conspiracy theorist who thinks that like what Mel Gibson got in trouble for, saying, oh, the Jews this, the Jews that, right? So, which is one of those specious arguments that are
right. Your reference to the minister who wouldn't say the pledge also made me remember another comment someone once made. But, he said the reason he doesn't do the pledge, he stopped doing it when he was a kid, was he said it the first time they asked him to do it, came back the next day, they wanted him to do it again. A week later, they still wanted him to do it, and he could see where this was going. A month later, a year later, and he realized they didn't believe him the first time he said it. And basically, the Pledge of Allegiance is the way the government tells you that they don't trust you, and they think you are a liar.
Yeah.
And that's what they're saying to you. We have children in schools say it every day. They're saying to the children, we don't trust you, and we think you were lying yesterday when you said it. And that's why we're going to have you do it more every day for 12 years of your life at the ring of a bell in a government school.
Wow.
Terrifying stuff.
Yeah, that's
and the amazing. The religious aspect is really sad. When they persecuted the people in the USA, they actually started the main U.S. Supreme Court case back in the 30s. It took them about 13 years before the U.S. Supreme Court issued its first opinion. The first opinion was actually 1940. They lost. The U.S. Supreme Court's original decision was yes. The schools can throw you out and expel you if you do not do the pledge. This was in 1940, right?
Right.
The USA enters the, and the war thing was really heating up. The U.S. enters the war in 1942, and in 1943 there's another decision that comes out. It was one of the quickest reversals of the U.S. Supreme Court. They reversed themselves and decided that, no, just because you don't want to do the pledge, we're not going to throw you out of the government schools. So that was an interesting, quick reversal by the U.S. Supreme Court. If you call 3 years quick, that is pretty quick for the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah. Wow. Do you think there was just a lot of political heat on them to, because it was so kind of egregious?
I don't think it was unlike what you were just describing earlier today. There's this paranoia among the government at that time because of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to refer to what's going on now as a war, but it was the same attitude, this paranoia in the government politicians. And that motivated that first decision where they were thinking... I think it was Frankfurter was thinking, we need to promote patriotism. We need to make people loyal. We need to make them do this, because the war is heating up. Things are scary. It's dangerous. Let's make them do this robotic chanting.
Mm-hmm.
And the amazing thing is, when you look back at it, that's 1940. We're not actually in the war yet. And we don't know at that time really who necessarily we will end up at war with.
Right.
We're doing the straight arm salute. The government is making kids robotically chant to the flag with the straight arm salute and expelling them if they don't. The same thing, in a sense, that is happening under the National Socialist German Workers' Party at the same time over there.
Hmm.
And, of course, they did it to their swastika flag, which, by the way, I had forgotten to mention, they didn't call it a swastika over there. They called it a Hakenkreuz, which it's one of the big, little-known facts that most people never learn. It wasn't called a swastika over there. They called it a Hakenkreuz, which means hooked cross, because it was a type of cross. And some people even tie that into the religious views of the leader of the National Socialist German Workers' Party.
So the cross
I mean, the swastika was meant to be like this. A representation of a religious government, socialist government, basically.
Right. Well, you know, he had a religious background, and it was even in Germany, it was an ancient symbol, which.
Right.
And they had lots of different crosses. They had the Ritterkreuz and the Iron Cross, the Knight's Cross, just all kinds of little crosses. They liked to stick them on medals and emblems and things. And this was a Hakenkreuz, hooked cross because of, you know, the hawks. That's the idea there. And so that is an interesting question. How much does it tie in to other things that have been written about his religious views, and how they tied into his persecution of people based on their religious views or ethnic background? Scary stuff. And in fact, we used to call it, we didn't just call it the swastika here. Even way back when, it was called the crooked cross, the twisted cross, the hooked cross. You know, we had other names for it that also used the cross reference. And it wasn't until later that swastika became the dominant reference to that symbol here. In fact, they didn't call it that over there. It makes you wonder why it became such a dominant reference here. In fact, it's so dominant here today that most people think that the German National Socialists called it a swastika. Mm-hmm. They didn't.
Right.
They called it a Hakenkreuz. In fact, some people use that to tie it into this occult Eastern religious theories that people have about the head of the German National Socialists.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't seem to realize that, you know, number one, he didn't call it a swastika. He called it a Hakenkreuz. So it ties in just as well with his regular religious views that he had at that time.
With things like Operation Paperclip, where they brought in the Nazi scientists to conduct and intelligence workers to put energy into our own intelligence apparatus, is there any reason to believe that that we didn't win World War II, and that basically all the ending of the World War II was about was just changing venues of this Third Reich from a German theater to an American theater? I mean, and especially with where we're going in the last 10 years or so, where it's becoming increasingly militaristic and imperialistic culture. I'd like to hear your commentary on kind of where we're going, and the historical antecedents that sort of put us on this track.
Well, the saddest thing to me about World War II is that in so many ways we ended up assisting the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. It was wonderful that the head of the German National Socialists was killed and that they were defeated. That was dandy. The problem was, in the process, Stalin also survived. He survived while Hitler did not.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Mao, of course, was
right.
Still alive.
Yeah.
It is very sad to note that they both went on to kill both independently triple the number of people that were killed under the National Socialist German Workers' Party. Of course, one reason they killed so many was because Hitler was dead, which is wonderful. That was fine, but it makes you wonder, how do you quantify that? How do you measure successes like that when you end up with Stalin still alive, Mao still alive, and they go on a killing spree that lasts decades after the end of the war in 1945? And, of course, you also tie it into whether we ended up using a lot of those people over there. Well, one of the reasons why we ended up wars are just so bizarre, as you can see today. They're as crazy as they are today. When your government says it knows what it's doing, they're insane. They have no idea what's going to happen. and what they're doing and how it's going to turn out. And we see that still today. Of course, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, and Japan was already in a pact with the German National Socialists. So as soon as Japan bombs Pearl Harbor, we declare war against Japan, and Germany, in its agreement that it already had with Japan, is obliged to declare war on us. That's one of the ways we ended up in the war the way we did. And that's one of the reasons why Stalin was still alive after it was all over, and we basically were involved in helping to divide up all the countries the U.S. Union of Soviet Socialist Republics got to keep and kill for decades. And then, of course, there was Mao over in China slaughtering people by the millions for decades.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. As I said before, it's 1935, the head of the height of the National Socialist German Workers' Party, Roosevelt, is imposing nationwide numbering on us. I'm glad he wasn't tattooing us at the time.
Right.
That'll probably come later, either that or RFID chips with the numbers and everything else, your whole life story there with the radio frequency ID chips. But it's already a number that follows you from cradle to grave. They give it to babies in schools, in hospitals, newborn babies, they do it. And then when you enter the government schools demand the number to enroll. It's a way to track you and tax you for your entire life.
So you would suggest to parents to
And that's what it's used for. It's a national ID number, and it's part of a massive socialistic system that still impoverishes the poorest people today and gives their money to people who are better off.
Yeah. So you would
squanders their savings.
You'd recommend to parents to not go into the Social Security Administration and get their number, their children numbered.
Oh, right. Yeah, I would definitely like that not to happen. I'd like to end the Social Security numbers, end the Social Security system. I'd like to end the government schools. And, you know, the weird thing about government schools, the government tells you that they know how to do it better. You're bad. We don't trust you. If we left it up to you guys, nothing would happen. And yet, they've been doing it forever. It goes down the toilet, and the whole theory behind their being able to teach you is that they do it better, and yet they make no effort to ever have you be self-sufficient or have you take over your own children's education. That's not even in the curriculum. That's not even part of the whole thought process there. Why? Because that isn't their intention. Their intention is they're going to run the schools. They're going to tell you what to think, and they're going to do it forever.
Yeah.
They want to control you. It isn't about the idea that they know how to turn you into a responsible parent who will take care of your own children's education. That isn't it at all.
Yeah, it's amazing. I'm kind of curious what motivates you. What do you see motivating you for into the future, and what do you think is some of our biggest challenges as far as collectively that we face, and maybe you individually, what do you choose to focus your attention on?
I like the pledge issue because it ties in so well to the worship of government, and as I'm a libertarian, it allows me to explain why the schools are used for brainwashing, why you never see the historical pictures. I can tie it into Social Security, the massive growth of government under FDR, and how we were following the same pattern, and still are, that was being set down by German National Socialists, the Union of Soviet Socialists, and Mao in China.
Yeah.
I've heard you talk about the income tax before, and wouldn't it be interesting if aside from just eliminating the income tax, which would be wonderful, imagine what would happen if you could just get rid of withholding.
Yeah.
And every year, the government, instead of taking the money out where people don't even see it, at the end of the year they said, you have to actually write out that check and hand it to us.
Yeah.
I think that would be fascinating.
Yeah.
But I'd like to end the income tax. The goal here is that our government is enormous. The current administration is out socializing the previous administration by more than double and growing,
yeah.
And that's in social spending alone.
Right.
You know, so it's amazing.
Not to mention the military.
Some of these people who support the current administration seem to act like they think that they're anti-government people who are trying to cut the size and scope of government. They're doing the complete opposite,
yeah.
To the tune of more than double and growing,
yeah.
In size and scope of the government. Nobody wants to pledge allegiance to the enormous debt that we have today that keeps growing and growing, where they figured out how to make babies, people who aren't even born yet, in debt for things their parents figured out how to make them pay for, their grandparents figured out how to make them pay for, numbering babies started by FDR. Nobody wants to pledge allegiance to all the crazy socialistic programs and the growing police state, which, by the way, the Pledge of Allegiance looks a lot like a police state activity. In fact, it seems to have a lot of ties to the National Socialist German Workers' Party. And Bellamy's book was read by Lenin's, probably Lenin, his wife reviewed it. Lenin's wife reviewed the book, and it was translated into every major language. People didn't really like Marx. I mean, they like to talk about it, but his stuff is turgid. It's complex. And Bellamy's book was sometimes sold with Marx, but Bellamy's book is attractive to people because it's this fanciful, feel-good utopia where he just asks you to assume that once socialism exists, it's going to be this wonderful world that he describes, which people attempted to create to the tune of 65 million dead in the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics and 49 million dead under Mao in China and 21 million dead under German National Socialism.
Wow.
And we're headed that way now. In fact, it looks like our government, the politicians, have started World War III and probably already lost it.
Well, to who? I mean, it sounds like it's a lose-lose situation already to start World War III. And I mean, you know.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be lose-lose if we don't start cutting the size and scope of government.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I've been saying this for decades myself, and all I do is sit back and watch people keep voting for the Democrat socialists or the Republican socialists, and the media act like there's only two candidates in every election, and
right.
It's absurd. They repeat the same trash over and over again for decades, and the media acts like it all makes sense, and it's just mind-boggling. And, of course, my explanation to you is, of course they do that. In 1892,
yeah.
Francis Bellamy created a Pledge of Allegiance. He wanted the government to take over all the schools. He started this robotic chanting. Edward Bellamy wrote about how wonderful socialism was. People went through it and still support it despite seeing all the worst records for mass slaughter set by the biggest socialist countries that inhabited the world. What's the puzzle there? I don't know. It makes that's why we're in the predicament we're in,
yeah.
And it's just getting worse.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Curry, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today. This has been a really interesting conversation, and I really appreciate your analysis. It's very interesting, and your research into the pledge is fascinating as well.
Well, I appreciate you having me on, Al, and I'll be happy to chat with you anytime.
Great.
Thanks
all right.
A lot.
Thanks
okay.
A lot. Bye-bye. And so we're just going to go ahead and go out with a song. This is Carl Klang, Turn Away from the Eagle. Of Cain,
Tower of Babylon, onto Egyptian pyramids. He flies from Rome to Washington. He flies for all the world to see this image of apostasy. His chosen son, the devil's number one. Turn away from the eagle. Turn away, turn away from this image and this idol. Turn away. Astray. Turn away from the eagle. Turn away. He strives to build his nest amid the planets, among the stars. He's left his mark on the lunar soil and on the monuments of Mars. Like the breach inside a wall, his pride will cause his crown to fall, and he'll come tumbling down just like a house of cards. Turn away from the eagle. Turn away, turn away from this image and this idol. Turn away. This world astray. Turn away from the eagle. Turn away. Thy kingdom come. Don't wait too long, too late to learn. You'll be the fuel this fire shall burn. You'll be the eagle's prey unless you turn and run. Turn away from the eagle. Turn away, turn away from this. From this.